introduction. You know him as the writer-director. He did Terminator, Terminator 2, The Abyss, and a little film known as Titanic. Not only is he a fantastic director, but it's crafted some of the greatest scripts in film history. Ladies and gentlemen, the legendary James Cameron. Since Titanic, there's been many big blockbuster science fiction films, and none of them have the heart of aliens. None of them have the humanity of Hudson and Hickson. And you love Bishop, but I want to give him a hug at the end. Do you feel that with the way with visual effects going, is there a danger in losing the Bill Paxton soul of these films?
I don't know, maybe. I mean, I think there are a lot of good storytellers out there, and I think there are a lot of good filmmakers that still have their heads screwed on straight about character and so on. But, you know, we didn't have, CG hadn't been invented yet when we made Aliens. I mean, it was still in the lab. It wasn't in movies yet, not for a few years. So, you know, we had to be more inventive, and we also had to make, the drama had to carry a lot of moments. And, you know, watching it now, I haven't seen the film in years, you know, really seeing how there's a lot of editing there that if you went one frame either side of what was used, it would be a piece of crap. And there's some stuff in the movie that we had to use that I'm not too proud of. So yeah, I think you had to be on the game as a storyteller a little bit more than that. So I think that while I think we all acknowledge that films kind of look better now because the creatures are cooler and everything moves better and CG allows us to do amazing things, I think the danger in that is that it's probably studios even more than filmmakers tend to rely on that more.
Do you feel there's more of a danger in losing the drama between people or the suspense is when she comes in, there's all those eggs and everyone's like, oh God. Is it more of a chance of losing the drama or the suspense that you could possibly?
I think there's probably definitely a tendency to lose suspense because spectacle tends to supplant suspense when people are sort of planning films and figuring out where to spend their money, because it's hard to think in advance how effective a moment can be just by dropping out the sound and having heavy breathing or something like that. We didn't have a choice then. You know, we just did what we could. We didn't, you know, we weren't tempted by the devil at that point.
How much planning goes in beforehand? Do you like to work on the fly as it goes and adjust as the film, or is it so much of the planning beforehand?
Well, I think, you know, fortune favors the prepared mind, you know, so you've got to be as prepared as you can be, but you also have to leave room for the magic of the moment and not be over-prepared. I've seen people be over-prepared and be blinded to a possibility, and sure, that possibility might upset people or, oh, the director's changing his mind. I sort of feel like it's the director's job to change their mind if it pluses the movie in that moment, if they see a target of opportunity, something an actor has brought to the moment, or just an alignment of things that was impossible to predict, you've got to go after it. You've got to chase it down and wrestle it to the floor and put it in the movie, because it'll be better than what you imagined sitting in a room months ahead of time.
Musically, this film is fantastic, both with Horner and as with the voices of both the musicality of each character in there. Now, when you create this ensemble, which is a science fiction ensemble piece, really, do you hear the music of each voice? Do you, when you were casting Bill Paxton, when you were casting Vasquez and everyone, all these great characters, do you hear the music with that as well?
That's an interesting kind of metaphor. I don't think I ever really saw it that way in the moment, but I think you are creating melody and counter melody with the different characters, the way they play off each other. And, you know, I think for me as a writer, you know, the characters become very real and palpable for me before the fact. So when an actor comes in and they can suddenly be that person, usually in a way I didn't expect, but suddenly I see it. I just have to cast them. It's that simple, you know. And casting is in some ways the most, you know, torturous part of making a movie, because you know if you mess it up, you're messing up your movie right now before you've even shot a foot of film. And I guess the good thing for me was that I didn't really know that when I was making Terminator and Aliens. I mean, I knew it intellectually, but I didn't sort of know it because I hadn't been through it enough to see how casting correctly really does save your butt. It makes you a better writer, makes you a better director, you know, because the actress can make even a kind of lame line live and breathe if they're good. You know, now with the benefit of experience, I get even more knotted up, you know, in the casting process, because you just have to get it right. That's the heart and soul of your movie. It doesn't matter how good a stylist you are as a filmmaker.
When I see a film like this, I can't even imagine the undertaking in which you're responsible for millions of dollars, giant effects, but at the same time you have to get a through line of just a person talking to a person trying to convince something. Is it important to cast it because you are dealing with so many gigantic things that you can rely on the actor's ability to just communicate? Or
yeah, I think you have to cast well, and then you have to give the actors time to work together and create that kind of team spirit. And you know, the ensemble effect, I think, was created for us here by giving them, much as Oliver Stone did with Platoon, he actually sort of put them through boot camp, or a collapsed version of it. We did the same thing. We had them out humping around the woods behind Pinewood Studio, you know, yelling cadences and carrying rifles and all that sort of thing, because, you know, they were a bunch of young actors and they didn't know anything about the military. It turned out that none of them actually did. So we had to get that spirit. Except for the guy that played Sergeant Opponent, he was actually a Marine. So I just said, okay, you whip them into shape. So I sicked him on the other actors.
Well, I'm sure I have 400 people here dying to ask questions, so I'm going to open it up to you guys quickly.
Thanks for coming, by the way.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Yeah. And we should all thank the American Cinematheque for the great job. Asking me kind of a loaded question, because I'm deep in CG hell right now. I think you know that. I think that it's very important to, if you're working in CG, to have had your hands in the slime of you know, the puppetry, the prosthetics, and all that, so that you know textures and you know how light works with surfaces and you know how to paint and all those things, and have worked with those people. And, you know, to create the kind of realism that we need in Avatar, for example, we've used those same people to create maquettes. You've got to have something physical that you can turn and move and adjust and light. We do lots of lighting tests, we do texture tests, we do lots of repainting. So we're still in the physical world until we transplant ourselves into the CG world. So I think working purely in CG is not a good way to go. And we're always constantly going back and doing photographic reference and so on. And I think, you know, still a lot of the answer is to mix prosthetics and puppetry with CG. And I think certainly we've been doing that. I think we are at a point right now where if you choose to do so, you could be 100% CG. I mean, actually, what you see on the screen could be 100% CG without it failing in some way, failing to meet the criteria of realism. It's more expensive, certainly. So, you know, this is going to boil down to different horses for different courses, different choices that filmmakers make. I hope that the arts of prosthetics, puppetry, mold making, and all those things don't fall by the wayside, because that's what keeps alive this whole community of artists and sculptors and so on who feed into that part of the process. We still need them, even in the CG realm. But in Avatar, for example, there are zero prosthetic effects of the kind that we did in Aliens, absolutely zero. But I used it was Stan Winston's studio at the time, before Stan passed away, and it's now Legacy Studios, which is now run by John Rosengrant and a couple of the Stan Winston guys. They were heavily involved in the design of all the creatures and so on. And I go back with them to Terminator in 1983. And so, you know, all of that skill set is still going to get used, even when people go pure CG.
How do you get the actor to feel comfortable and to be able to give his performance in such a CGI world, to know that they're just talking to a piece of tape or something like that? How do you do that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In Aliens, pretty much everything was there. There was very little that wasn't there. Even when things were blowing, the whole, you know, power station is blowing up at the end. You know, we actually did it with rear projection, so Sigourney could see it for her timing. And the alien queen was there; it was full size. So, but I always felt that it was Sigourney's performance, us looking at her, looking at it, that was much more powerful and made it seem more real to us than the actual thing itself did. It's kind of like, as long as the creature did no harm in your sense of believability, it was her investing it with life that made us believe it. So when an actress staring at a green screen, you know, I have to make sure, and they have to make sure that they have that same commitment. But it's really not a problem. If an actor can come in on an audition sitting in an office in you know, Santa Monica and sell me on a moment of human authenticity, then they can do it in front of a green screen. They can do it anywhere. It comes from the inside out. Now, you know, the more that I can do as a director to make it real for them, palpable in some way, the better it will be. So, you know, for example, on Avatar, we use a virtual camera to show them what's happening. They have to do it after the take, but after the take, they come over and say, oh, that's there, and so on. But they still have to be good.
Is that rendered pretty...
It's a real-time rendering system, so they can actually see what they just did, essentially.
Mm. Right there.
You just asked about five questions there. Question number one was digital versus film. I've been shooting digitally since 2000. I haven't shot any film since then, other than some Dark Angel episodes, but I didn't direct those myself. So I'm totally sold on digital production at the camera and throughout the entire production chain, right down to digital projection. I love digital projection. So I'm all the way gone. On that. You're not going to talk me out of it. In terms of you know, I guess the second part of the question was, I've kind of lost track because they were like before the exhibition, the Dark Knight, what do we see coming up? I thought Dark Knight was an interesting experiment. I don't see a lot of movies doing that necessarily. It worked a whole lot better than I thought it was going to when I heard what they had done, because it was exciting. I thought it was more exciting when they went to IMAX than the sense of loss when they went back to just a straight scope ratio. So it was kind of all on the plus side. I'd love to see a whole movie made in the IMAX format. I think it'd be great. For Avatar, we're shooting in a 16:9 ratio. We're extracting a CinemaScope ratio from that for 2D theatrical exhibition. And for 3D theatrical exhibition, we will do in the theaters that can, will be in the 16:9 format, and the theaters that can't will be in the scope format. Because I actually think that the extra screen height really works well in 3D. It really pulls you through the screen. So I'm actually going back on years of kind of eschewing the kind of 1.85 format. Now saying 1.85, or actually it's 1.78:1, actually works really well in 3D, but only in 3D. I still like the scope ratio compositionally, you know, for flat projection. So obviously, I'm way down the path on stereoscopic 3D in theaters, and I think it's going to be, you know, kind of the next big revolution. I think, you know, the exhibitors are there, but they're there in the kind of for certain types of films. They still, in their minds, kind of ghettoize it to films for kids, animation, Pixar films, so on, and they look gorgeous, but I think that filmmakers haven't really embraced the idea of doing dramatic narrative live-action films in 3D yet, other than, you know, kind of My Bloody Valentine, stuff like that, which has always been around, that idea that you'll do a horror film in 3D because it's cool and it's a gimmick and it's, you get a kind of a sugar high out of it or something. You know, to actually make a serious movie in 3D, like an honest-to-God serious movie, like for example, Titanic. I would make Titanic right now. If I hadn't made the film already, I'd make it in 3D. Didn't have much choice on that. In Aliens. Yeah, sure. Casting Jessica was one of the scariest things we did. It was a 17-year-old girl that had to carry the whole series on her back, you know, and yeah, she's fantastic, of course. For me, every film has been kind of unique. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio in The Abyss is a very different character than Sigourney's character. Linda Hamilton in the Terminator film is very different. In fact, she's different between the two films. Or, you know, her character evolved. I mean, I guess I've challenged myself to not do kind of simply iconic female characters, meaning, you know, they're babelicious and they kick ass, and that's all we need to know. So that's never been kind of enough, you know. I think that some human complexity and some backstory and some darkness was necessary, and you know, just writing complex characters, you know, male or female. Although, you know, I mean, I knew that I was going to be telling a story that had a female main character. The ensemble kind of orbits around her, but she's still the center of it. So that's where the child character came from, because, you know, I was exploring these kind of maternal themes in a very unlikely setting. And I think that's one of the things that people kind of thought was cool about the movie. But, you know, the idea of the new character came out of knowing that I was going to be, you know, doing Ripley again, but wanting to change Ripley, give Ripley some dimension. And I'll be, sorry. Yeah, probably. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, she was a good role model. Yeah. Right there, Sam.
Your screenplays have a very epic structure to them. How important is outlining to you when you sit down to write? And also, how would you say your screenwriting habits have changed since writing this movie and today?
I think I still have all the same bad habits I had back then. I'm just slower now, you know. I mean, I think Terminator was written in about 3 weeks, and Aliens was written in about 5 weeks, and then The Abyss was like 8 weeks, and it just add a few weeks each time. I think Avatar took like 3 or 4 months. Something like that. I think in terms of habits, you know, in terms of outlining and things like that, actual process, I start to write a simple 5-page outline, and I usually stop when I hit about 50 or 60 pages. It's just, I just have to kind of get inside it, you know. And that usually happens very quickly. Taking that 50 or 60 page, very novelistic document, try to beat it back into a screenplay form that's a series of images and dramatic moments, that's more difficult. I usually wind up having to throw big chunks of it out. So I throw some chunks of it out when I'm writing the screenplay, and then I throw other chunks of it out when I'm in prep, and they tell me I don't have enough money, and then I shoot more than I need, and I throw more out later, and then the actors all get pissed off at me because their favorite line is missing or something. It's a process of attrition, I guess, to just win, you know, kind of hone it down to the best stuff. I always say there's a lot of marble lying around on the floor when somebody makes a sculpture, and it's sort of like that. Studio does not want to hear that.
Right there.
Actually, I've been working on the crew for a long time, so I don't know if it's abrasive, but you have quite a reputation for erupting, you and Michael Mann. So I'm just wondering...
No, wait a minute. He's a psycho. What are you talking about? Have you ever worked on one of my crews?
No, but I'm...
See, this is how stuff gets spread around. Total hearsay. You come work on one of my crews, and then you can form your own opinion. How's that sound? Okay, what do they say? Come on, you started this. You're not going to weasel out of it like that. Come on, bring it. Oh, you think where I've hurt the film by being an asshole?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to sum up what he's playing. No, I don't think so. I think there are moments, especially earlier on, that I might have regretted after the fact. And I think I was usually man enough to go to that person and apologize, for an outburst, or me making my problem their problem, which, I was certainly known to do. I think there's a lot less of that these days, because I think leadership is an important aspect of directing. It took me a while to figure that out. I just thought it was about being an artist and, getting your shit on the screen and, all that sort of thing and telling the story. But, then I realized, it took me a while to realize it. Some people get this right away. I'm sure Ron Howard on like day one knew it. Took me 20 years to figure out. But you have to lead people, You have to lead a group of people to do something. They're not going to be as passionate about it as you are, because they're going to be on the next gig and then the next gig, And so you have to, you treat them as people, and you got to get them inspired about what they're doing in that moment. And respect them for what they know. Because, really, you wouldn't have hired them in the first place if they weren't, if not the best, the best you could find at that moment, And usually they're going to be pretty good, pretty experienced. And you got to respect them for that. And, it took me a while to figure out some of that stuff. So I apologize to all your friends. Very different. I'm just going to phone it in from now on. I'm done with the challenge. This shit's too hard. No, I like a challenge. I mean, everybody sort of thought I was loafing off for the last few years. But I was doing stuff that was actually harder than making films and loving it for that reason. Because if something doesn't work out on set, you can always reshoot it. You go out in the ocean, you make a mistake, you're either dead or you're certainly not going to accomplish your goals. And the ocean does not accommodate mistakes. So I actually found that to be a really, kind of honing experience. And, I learned a lot about leadership and working with small teams and so on. And plus I saw the most amazing things I could imagine, things that all the effects in Hollywood can't create because they're not real, So maybe I got a little seduced by that, because there was a certain sort of fork in the road in my life where I either wanted to go be a scientist, science geek, or I wanted to be a writer and an artist. I couldn't really decide between the two, and I finally decided to, because, I got a C in calculus. So I decided to, be an artist, be a writer. But I've always loved the sciences and exploration and all that, so I went off to do that for a while. But I used the filmmaking as a way to fund it and a way to bring something to it that the science community and the exploration community were a little weak in, So I had a great time. I don't regret a second of it, and I'll probably go do some more of that in the future. But it's also great to be back in the saddle making a movie, and making a movie that I know, win, lose, or draw, whether it's a good film or not, I know there's going to be images in this film we're making right now that are going to blow people away. They're just like, what the fuck? Because we say that when we see the shots coming back from what a digital is like. They sent us a shot last week, I said, this is ridiculous. So, I don't know if it's going to add up to be a great film, but I already feel proud that there's some cool stuff in it. Right there.
Two questions. One, what do you expect to gain from it? And two, when you're actually screening, I know you mentioned it's two
Yeah. I don't know if everybody heard it, but he's asking if we're making Avatar, if we're looking at it in 3D and then looking at it in 2D. It's really kind of the other way around. I operate the camera myself for the most part when I can. I'm looking through at a 2D image in the eyepiece. I compose the shots at the monitor in 2D. I edit in 2D on the Avid. But we have 3D viewing right on set with us, either in the form of a large stereo monitor or, and we always have nearby a 2K DLP projector, like a movie projector, like you'd have in the booth of a movie theater, sitting right nearby. So if there's any doubt about a shot, we just walk over and look at it in projection. It's like you're literally watching the movie while you're making the movie. It's very cool. Very soon.
All the way back.
Like third or...
Going back to the stereo exhibition, what would a stereo presentation of a drama like Titanic add to the storytelling? Or a romantic comedy? I mean, I think
any cinematic moment is enhanced by a sense of presence, that you're there, that the thing is actually happening, a greater suspension of disbelief. I think there are films that will benefit less than that, less, and some benefit more. I think a drama, not necessarily science fiction or fantasy or action, but a straight drama would benefit greatly from being in 3D, because you're just going to feel like you're there with these people and you're going to be on their journey that much more. The question is it economically feasible to do that? Is there enough perceived additional upside to pay for doing it in 3D? Because 3D is more expensive. It costs another 10-15% beyond the base budget of the movie to do it in 3D. So I would say Titanic, while it's a drama, also has a lot of strong visual moments in it that are purely cinematic visually, including the big effects finale. So there's a film where I think that while all of those scenes, the effects scenes, I think everybody would feel that it would obviously benefit from being in 3D. You'd really feel like you're on the ship, you were really down in those corridors and so on. What people don't realize yet, and I'm seeing it every day in Avatar, is that a straight dramatic scene is much more powerful because you really feel like you're there. So it really just boils down to the economics. I think a drama like Titanic, you could justify the economics, and a small drama, especially an independent film, I don't think you could justify it right now. The question is, when does 3D become ubiquitous, and when is it the way we watch movies? Is it like sound, where the first time people, saw movies with sound, all movies had to be sound or they couldn't compete? No, I don't think it's like that. Is it like color? Probably more like color. Because color came in the mid to late 30s, but it wasn't until the 60s where all films were made in color. And people were...
When do you think the stereoscopic is going to become ubiquitous?
I think it depends on the adoption at the consumer level. I could see easily 5 years from now, it's spreading rapidly into the home and to portable devices and laptops and so on, and systems where you don't need glasses, on the smaller displays. You'll still need them in theaters, I think, probably indefinitely. Or it could take longer than that. But I can imagine a world where it always is a kind of niche market, and I can imagine a world where every bit of media that you see and absorb in a day is to some extent or other stereoscopic. Because what do all day long is we look at screens. We look at screens at work, and then we go home and look at screens. So if there's a way to make the screen-looking part of our lives better and richer, that's going to be powerful.
What you play is in three dimensions, and it's very powerful to watch Death of a Salesman in three dimensions.
That's right. Yeah, it could be. As a film, you're talking about actually the experience of a play, the proceeding.
Play, that's in three dimensions.
Yeah.
Right there.
Bill and I had fun on that. We had a lot of fun on that. an unusual film because Arnold actually brought me the idea. You know, there was this little French film called La Totale, and he said, "You gotta see this movie. I think this could be an interesting character for me." I'd never heard him talk like that before. So I better go see it. So, you know, we screened the film, and I could just kind of get my mind around how he could be like this James Bond character. But what was hysterical about it, and because I know Arnold so well, and his wife Maria, and so on, I knew how in love they were, and how marriage was a really important part of his life. I thought the dichotomy of that, you know, the kind of the Superman, the Ubermensch, you know, who could do anything, but he's still got to come home and answer to his wife. I thought that was a pretty damn funny idea, and I thought it was funny because it was a nice overlay of a character onto Arnold as a guy, you know. So it was just intriguing. I said, all right, let me take a stab at the script, and strange, I was really nervous about the comedy because, you know, I mean, it's one thing to make people laugh in a moment in a suspense film where you're kind of keyed up and it doesn't take much to get a laugh, but to actually stand up and say, okay, we're going to make you laugh every 5 minutes, you know, that's a pretty scary thing. So I wrote the script. I didn't think it was funny enough. I hired a couple of, like, crack comedy screenwriters to come in. They botched the whole thing. It was one I'll be back line after another. They totally missed the tone, so I threw that out, and then I was out of time. So we started shooting the script, you know, shooting the film, and I thought, well, maybe we'll find something funny as we go along. And it actually just turned out to be funnier than I thought it was on the page. Yeah, no, he was in the French film. That guy, the skeezy car salesman, was in the French film. Yeah, but it was a role made for Bill. Bill made up some of his own dialogue there. I mean,
might we see Bill in Avatar?
Well, yeah. Bill and I are close pals, but you know he had his TV show. Yeah, we loved him.
Right there.
Like Terminator? Well, Terminator was kind of my sacrificial lamb, so to speak. You know, it was the first thing I wrote. I didn't have any money, didn't have any entree to the business, really. And, you know, I had to kind of give away the farm to get the gig to direct it. So what I got out of it was a directing career. And I was lucky enough to get to make the second film. They came back to me on that one. And I was in post-production on Titanic, and we started talking about a third Terminator film, and my heart just wasn't in it. I was making Titanic. I felt like I'd sort of moved into other, you know, other ideas and other things I wanted to try. And then that sort of fell apart. And then those guys ran off with the rights and decided to do it themselves. And so there was some kind of bad blood around that. And then you know, I just sort of reconciled myself to the fact that, you know, someday I was going to see a Terminator movie that I had nothing to do with, even though I created the franchise initially. And Arnold came to me and he kept trying to talk me into doing, you know, Terminator 3, you know, get the team back together and all that. And I said, look, just go make the money, but promise me you will ask them for the most money anybody has ever made. And he said, well, what do you think I should ask for? And I told him, and he said, really? I said, sure, are you kidding? They're going to make the movie without you? That'd be stupid. I can't pass that one up. Okay, we'll do it as soon as we break here. I'll just hit the right out.
We have time. We have time for about two more questions here. We'll go right there.
Because the abyss is long, folks.
Types of movies would you want to tackle in the future that you find challenging that you haven't?
haven't done yet, and who of the actors that you've worked with in all your previous films, certainly you're working with Sigourney Weaver again, who would you like to work with again in a future film that you've worked with?
I still have, you know, a lot of good friends from amongst my previous casts, and when a role is right for them, you know, they'd be my first call. I admit that sometimes I think, oh well, that's too easy. That casting idea is too easy because it's like something they did before. I actually didn't call Sigourney initially for Avatar. So I thought, oh well, it'll just be like Aliens, you know. And then at a certain point, I just slapped myself and went, it's Sigourney. Of course, she's perfect for this, you idiot. So you know, I called her up. Unfortunately, she liked the character. Yeah, I mean, I think I can't think of any actors that I've worked with that I wouldn't, you know, look forward to the opportunity to work with again. But you got to weigh that against the fact that I don't make that many movies. And most directors don't, by the way. I mean, some kind of churn them out. But, you know, most it's a year, every couple of years maybe. Whereas actors are doing, you know, four, five, six movies a year. So they work a lot more with different people than we get to do. So, you know, there's so many actors that I admire that I haven't worked with, and I got to weigh it against that, too. That, you know, every time I go see a film, practically, I see somebody say, I got to work with that guy, or I got to work with her, you know, just because I'm impressed by what they do. That's one of the things that excites me and keeps me going, is the idea of working with actors. I love that moment of creation, you know. You come in the morning, and you got a couple of pages, you know, some lines on it. When you go home at night, something has been stamped onto the negative or onto the tape that is different from what you imagined and is a communal creation. And it's that moment that I don't care how many storyboards you draw or how much prep you have and how many notes you get from the studio, that's the sacred moment.
We have time for one more question, and we're going to go right there.
First off, I'll vote for Michael Biehn in another James Cameron movie.
He's a good man.
I was curious, the camera system in Avatar, not the 3D, but the rendering specifically, I guess I want to know, A, when you're rendering on set, I mean, is it just as fully rendered as it is when we see it on screen? And secondly, how long do you think it'll be before, or if, we see that technology percolating widely through action, adventure, sci-fi movies?
Yeah, I think that, you know, some people that have seen some of the Avatar footage have said, wow, this is really revolutionary, it's going to change how films are made. I actually think that's not the case, because they'd be looking at the CG stuff, the performance capture stuff, and even though we're pretty pleased with how our methodology worked out to do that, I don't think everybody in Hollywood's going to run out and start doing performance capture movies, because they're, for one thing, ridiculously expensive. And two, there's a pretty steep learning curve for how you do it. Not for the actors, but for the filmmaker side. What I do think is revolutionary out of what we created for the film was this little thing called the simulcam, where I was working with a virtual camera. I was working in a virtual environment wherever I pointed my camera, which wasn't a camera at all. It was just an input device to the computer. I could see what was in that world. I could see the virtual characters. I could maneuver around, do shots. I thought, well, wait a minute, if we can do it with this thing, why can't we do that with a camera? Why can't we overlay the one technology on the other and do this on a live-action set where we, instead of looking at a blank green screen, we have a real-time track using this motion capture technology, and we generate a live, real-time, rendered image of what's going to be on that green screen. And it worked. We built it, took a year to build, and it worked beautifully. And so we were able to interact a live-action camera, live-action performers, with CG characters and CG environments in real time. And I couldn't shoot without it right now in the types of stuff that we're doing. That, I think, will be revolutionary, because if you look at where films are trending, kind of starting with Robert Rodriguez in Sin City, where he said, you know, all this set building, forget it. Let's just use a green screen. You know, and he created this intensely graphic-looking film, and then that was carried forward by Zack Snyder and 300 and so on. And people are, I think, you know, weaning themselves off the big physicality of filmmaking, going directly to a kind of very artistic form of creation. But it's scary for a lot of filmmakers because they can't see what's happening. And it's, I think it's scary for some actors because they can't see what's happening. Well, this forms a bridge where, yeah, you can't see it in the moment, but you can walk over to the monitor and play back the take and see what it was. And if I'm operating the camera, I can operate to what's to what's going to be there later. Now, the first part of your question was, is it at a level that you finally see? Well, there's the rub. We got to render in real time. So you're talking about something that looks like a video game, not even like a really good video game, like a kind of 80s video game. But that's just a matter of time. That's just a matter of compute power and storage, you know, and that stuff keeps going up by Moore's Law. And we've seen a huge improvement even while we've been making Avatar. We look at the stuff we did 2 years ago in the pre-visualization days, it's laughable now compared to what we're doing now. But you got to remember that to render a world and the characters in it in real time, it's, you know, pretty few polygons and simple textures and that sort of thing. You know, our stuff's got to render in a 30th of a second. To put that in perspective, the final shots coming back from Weta Digital take 50 to 100 hours per frame to render.
Whoa.
Per processor, per computer. So obviously they put 6,000 processors on the job and they get 4 or 5 shots per night.
So that brings up one thing. So the characters you're seeing the simulcam are behaving while you're looking at them through the camera?
Yeah, the idea of simulcam originally was that I'd actually have somebody performing a character in performance capture and feeding it into a live-action image and actually be able to interact a live performer in the live-action shoot, in the photographic shoot, with somebody who's nearby in a capture volume. We found out in practice that even though that was possible, it wasn't desirable because the live actors couldn't see the guy. So we found out that it was better to have to play back that performance so that essentially he was always hitting his marks in the same place so that they could learn the eye lines and so on. So it gets a little bit technical. The next phase of it, if I was going to do it again, and if there were enough scenes to justify it, we'd actually put in a servo-actuated system that created an eye line marker that moved around. And I don't mean just like a little red dot. I mean like a moving monitor screen that fed in the actor's face and voice to a point in space that the other guy could play to. Now you're talking about true simulcam. And we could have done it, we just didn't justify the expense because we only had a couple of scenes that where it would have been necessary.
Well, I feel like we just heard something historical off air. Thank you for coming down. Thank you for coming down.